Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of INFORUM, the Commonwealth Club's Innovation Lab. You can find INFORUM online at inforumsf.org. I'm Kishore Hari, director of the Bay Area Science Festival, and tonight we're here with INFORUM to award SALCON with INFORUM's 21st Century Visionary Award. SALCON is founder of Khan Academy, a free online education platform that has impacted tens of millions. You're a teacher to all of us. Even to my mom. He's changed the conversation on who, how, and where quality education content is accessed. So let's all give a big hand for SALCON. And I want to start there. You are a teacher to tens of millions, but still a teacher to all of us individually. Where did you learn to learn?
I don't know. I think it's a growing up. I was always kind of just naturally, I guess, curious. But I don't think that was anything special. I think a lot of children, frankly, all children, grow up very curious. Maybe I was a little bit more stubborn in my curiosity. And I think that coupled with, so I always wanted to draw connections between things, but then you couple that with, I've also always been very sensitive to tone, which is if, you know, someone talks to me in a way that's even slightly condescending or slightly pedantic or slightly arrogant, I really respond badly to that. And on one level, that could be a not the best trait to have, but I think maybe, you know, I'm definitely not the first person to put educational videos online or even on YouTube, but maybe what I think maybe it is that me listening to myself to make sure I don't have that tone that would put me off or make something seem stressful to me, hopefully is connecting with folks.
And you've come a long way from MS Paint in a closet.
Yes.
With those, I think most here in the audience and listening are familiar with some of the origin stories of you creating some of these videos for your cousins. But when you were first doing that, did you expect any of this? Tens of millions of people accessing the site, leadership in the space of online education.
Who wouldn't when you... No. As you know, I have a lot of fantasies and daydreams, some education-related, some not. No, I didn't, you know, there was a part of me that always wanted to do something in education, and I had always kind of, you know, part of my rationalization for being an analyst at a hedge fund was that, you know, I could maybe one day, you know, make enough money to start a school on my own terms and be kind of a Dumbledore-like figure. I thought that would be a good way to spend a life. When I uploaded those first few, you know, and very rough videos on YouTube, as you mentioned, using Microsoft Paint and, you know, a $20 headset, I had no idea that it would, you know, it would be watched and hopefully help so many people.
So why do you think it did explode? What did you strike in the audience that was watching that really landed so much that it grew in such exponential terms?
Yeah, you know, do you know what was really surprising was all the videos since, but even those first few videos, I assumed it would be kind of a thing only for a certain type of student. And in my brain, it was the student that I was when I was 13 years old. You know, it was someone who wanted to see the connections, someone who didn't want to memorize the formula, someone who wanted to, you know, have all those why questions answered. And so I really just tried to do that. And I was like, but most people aren't going to be interested in this. They're going to want the formula. They're going to want this. They're going to want that. But the big takeaway is, no, it's the exact opposite, is that that's actually what people have been hungry for. I think a lot of students who, you know, when they tell someone that I'm bad at math, the reaction that someone gives to them is they talk slower or they talk down to them. Okay, let's, you know, but that's not... That's actually not the issue. What they're probably saying is that they wish they could understand the why of math a little more, why it's beautiful, what are the connections here, and not just in math, whether it's, you know, it's physics, chemistry, history, all of these are, you know, they're beautiful subjects if you really draw the connections. And I think for me, a lot of the fun, obviously I was helping my cousins, but the fun for me was to revisit all of these subjects with kind of having the time to dig as deep as I've always wanted to when, you know, you don't have the, you know, term paper due tomorrow and you know, whatever else. And so what was really surprising to me is how that connected with people. You know, a lot of times in the media now you have this, you know, it's pretty, you know, it seems almost like a dumbing down of you know, what happens on the news or what happens on TV. And I think actually people are really hungry for things that are a little bit more or a lot more substantive, start to connect things that treat them as, you know, an intelligent person. And, you know, the letters that we got even in those early days in 2006, 2007 were, I was failing algebra, and now that I understand where the quadratic formula comes from, I'm now pumped about algebra. And that was surprising to me, but very refreshing.
What did it take to say, oh, this is something that there's so much hunger out there for that I have to quit being a hedge fund angelist?
Yes. So... So early on, I mean, you know, famously, I was telling my cousin, I was doing these online tutoring sessions with them, and after a couple of months, I started producing these videos that were really on the questions that I felt like I was answering over and over again. And I told my cousins, why don't you watch these, and I'll make more videos for you. And, you know, they famously gave that, you know, that backhanded feedback that they liked me better on YouTube than in person. So that was the first sign that there was something. And then, you know, it was just public. It was out on YouTube, and
people on YouTube only say nice things.
Exactly, exactly. No, that's exactly right. You know, I was after a few months, it was clear from the view count that people who were not my cousins were watching, and and you know, some of the comments were, you know, just a simple thank you. And to your point, most of the comments on YouTube are not thank you. They are. But then people would write, hey, you know, this helped me pass algebra. I used to hate math. Now I want to be a physicist. And, you know, just one comment like that, you're like, wow, that, who would have thought that, you know, just a little viewing something in a slightly different way, feeling like they could actually understand something could change a trajectory. And in my mind, even at that early point, I was like, wow, if this is just an artifact for my family, I didn't have kids then, I have kids now. I said, well, if my grandkids could get benefit from it, this is worth doing. And there's just some random people there. And at the time, it was in the hundreds. It wasn't in the, you know, tens of millions. But I was like, well, even if it's 10 people who it changes the truth, this is absolutely worth doing. So I kept going. But it wasn't until 2009, about 3 years after the first video, 5 years after I started tutoring my cousins, that... You know, the site had just, it was like, I don't know, at that point it was several hundred, maybe 100,000 people a month. I was getting all of these letters. You know, I was frankly having trouble focusing on my day job. And, you know, I figured I wasn't fulfilling my fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders of the investors in the fund.
Honest hedge fund analyst? Is that the moral hedge fund analyst?
I'll actually defend the industry a little bit, but no, it's actually, you know, hedge fund is just both of my bosses I had were extremely amazing mentors, and you know, I anyone who's skeptical out there are definitely some bad actors in the industry, but there are some definitely some very good actors. And I mean, on an unrelated note, I would Khan Academy would not exist if not for the fact, and this is going to surprise people because it's not what you typically hear when you think of Wall Street or hedge funds, but my boss for 6 years, Dan Wohl, he told me to go home. And he told me to recharge, and he told me to have a life, and he told me to, because, you know, his whole point is our job is not to, like, work ourselves, overburn ourselves and make a ton of bad decisions. Our job is to make good decisions, and you have to invest in your family and your friend circle and your hobbies. And it was, and so we worked from 5 in the morning till 2 p.m., and so I had all this time in the afternoon to tutor cousins and work on Khan Academy. So, but you know, by 2009, I just frankly had trouble focusing on my day job. It looked like something was here. We had a little bit of savings for a down payment, essentially, on a house. So my wife and I, we kind of sat down and said, okay, let's give it a shot. And we kind of gave ourselves a year time limit to see if it could turn into something.
But that transition from I'm going to start making more videos online to actually forming a company... take us inside that story. Like, what was there a pivot point where you got to say, this is an actual company, we're making a platform, we're doing something bigger?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was a big change. I think it was around 2007 that I started to appreciate that there was something real here. Mm-hmm. And as it grew, in 2008 was when we incorporated as a not-for-profit for the first time. And even at that time, I thought, okay, this is great. A lot of people mm-hmm. seem to be excited about this. Maybe I could get some philanthropic funding. Maybe I can find some volunteers to help me with this. But in 2009, kind of the jump to make this your life, it was a scary thing. I mean, I think it was more of, you know, my son had just been born. My wife was still in training. She was a medical resident. We had just had to rent a bigger house because my mother-in-law was moving in and all. So it was definitely a stressful time. And, and I think like any entrepreneurial endeavor, whether it's for profit or not for profit, you always jump into it maybe blindly optimistic, like, oh, you know, surely, I was already talking to a few foundations, surely someone's going to fund this thing, the social return on investment's so high, but, you know, you go 6-7 months into it, and it was kind of, no one had funded it yet, and we were digging into our savings about $5,000 a month, we had a newborn, it was a stressful time.
And what turned the corner? Do you remember that first check that came in?
I remember every one of them. we're eating sushi tonight. And I have to say, like, even from the get-go, like, even before I quit my job, there was a little PayPal link, and we were getting, especially once I quit my job, there was about, you know, people were giving $5, $10, $50 donations. Every now and then a $100 donation came through. It was amounting to about several hundred dollars a month. If it was any of you, thank you. That was helping. But it definitely was not enough to live off of and do forever. But it was in May 2010 that all of a sudden a $10,000 donation came through. I saw who it was. Her name, Ann Doer. Her email address was there. I immediately emailed her. Thank you so much for this incredibly generous donation. It was the largest donation that Khan Academy has ever received. If we were a physical school, you would now have a building named after you. And Anne wrote back saying, well, I'd love to meet. I use it. I'm based in Palo Alto. I'd love to. And we met. And it was at an Indian buffet restaurant in downtown Palo Alto. And Anne asks, so, you know, what's your goal here? And I said, look, you know, when I filled out the paperwork to be a 501c3 with the IRS, there's a little part, you know, mission colon and like a line and a half. And I filled out a free world-class education for anyone anywhere. And Anne said, well, that's ambitious. how do you see yourself doing that? And I said, well, you know, it's just a mission. I don't plan to just check it off tomorrow and then move on to healthcare or something. But but I showed her. I was walking around with like a notebook of the testimonials, these letters from students, parents all over the world. I showed her kind of the growth on the site. I showed her kind of the software, the exercises that I had working on, so people can get practice and all that. And Anne said, well, you know, it's pretty surprising. You're actually making a lot of progress. I only have one question. How are you supporting yourself? And in as proud of a way as possible, I said, I'm not. She kind of processed that, and we parted ways. And literally 10 minutes later, I was driving to the driveway in Mountain View, you know, neighboring town, and I get a text message from Ann, and it says, you really need to be supporting yourself. I've just wired you $100,000. So that was a good day.
You did go out for sushi that night.
Yeah, I did.
Why not for profit? Why free? In an industry where we pay for education in every opportunity we can, I have a 3.5-year-old at home. My bank account reflects that. It's an interesting choice to be not for profit.
Yeah, no, and you know, there's two dimensions there. There's free and there's not for profit. And as you know, Stanford or UCSF will show you, they're not always the same thing. No, I'm kidding. He's from UCSF. That's the So I think those are two separate. I think not for profit. When I first incorporated as a not for profit in 2008, my day job was doing nothing but talking to for profit public companies and thinking about capital structure and incentives and whatever else. And I did a thought experiment. I was like, okay, so let's just imagine that this thing is successful. And, you know, let's say I'm 80 years old, I'm looking back on my life, and let's just imagine a home run in the for-profit realm and a home run in the not-for-profit realm, and which one would I prefer? And neither one is necessarily bad. But in the for-profit realm, it's like, okay, I'll get some venture funding, I'll build a team, I'll, you know, and a home run would, you know, a success would be get acquired, IPO, home run would be, you know, kind of be the next Silicon Valley big thing. You know, that'd be great. I could buy new clothes and, you know, whatever. I don't want to be disparaging of that, because through a for-profit, you could impact and improve the lives of a lot of people. And I think there are for-profits that are doing that. But I said, well, are any of these kind of turning into long-lasting institutions that are, you know, multi-generational? And you know, there's a few companies that kind of do that, but very few of them really stick to their mission. And then I thought about it from the, you know, when I said, well, I'm going to keep doing this as a legacy, just even for my own family. And I started thinking, well, I know a lot of entrepreneurs who their business got acquired, it was a success, but then what they were doing just kind of got put in the closet, or it wasn't. And I was like, well, that would be the for me personally, selfishly, that would be the worst feeling if this thing that I'm trying to produce isn't able to reach folks. On the other side of it, I did study corporations for a living. This was what I did at a hedge fund, and I saw how hard, even when the founder had the best intentions, how hard it is for them to stay focused on their initial founding mission, especially when it goes beyond them, when it goes to their children, when it becomes a public company, when you have investors. And the last thing I would have wanted is this thing, Khan Academy, which really is about a free world-class education for anyone, anywhere, to ever become about something other than that. You sometimes hear words like double bottom line and triple bottom line and this and that. I think there's a reason why it's called bottom line. Like you want what's on the bottom, you know. And I think, you know, the not-for-profit's the only way to make sure that you're focused on that one bottom line.
So where are we now? We're 6-7 years into this experiment. How many folks are accessing Khan Academy? What is the experience like now?
Yeah, so I mean, first I'll say kind of what Khan Academy is now, because you know, I think a lot of times, and we've just talked about how it started with the videos, and the videos are still a big piece of Khan Academy, but we're now 70 folks, and most of what we're focused on is really the interactive experience of Khan Academy. So even in that first conversation with Ann Doerr, I told her about, like, the real vision here isn't just videos, it's to have interactive exercises, ways to connect students, ways for them to help each other. And so that's what the team of 70 folks is now working on. So now if you go to Khan Academy today, you can log in or not, but you can get interactive exercises, especially in math. It's very deep. You can start wherever you are. It's completely standards aligned and go all the way through college level calculus, statistics, and beyond. We have, on the video side, we have things in art history. Actually, this is something, you know, people often associate kind of math, science with Khan Academy, but we have two art historians who, you know, we did what I call a not-for-profit merger. We gave them jobs. And they had jobs. They were, this is what they wanted to do. But we actually have the largest collection of art history videos on the internet, and we have partnerships with folks like the Getty and the the Met. And I mean, you could. So there's a very strong right brain piece of it. We have a computer science platform. In terms of, you know, now I think, you know, we're probably going to reach 15 million students this month, maybe more. So we've internationalized Brazilian Portuguese, Spanish, Turkish, French. Our goal is to launch in all of the world's major languages in the next 5 or 10 years. And
wonderful. And I've heard you say many times that it's not the power of Khan Academy is not the videos. It's the software that's in behind it. So yeah. Take us into what that is and what you mean by that.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, I think the videos are—they're nice. There's a way for people to connect with it, and hopefully it does kind of make people form a human bond with them. But to really learn something, you want to get practice. You want to get feedback. You want you want other people in the community to be able to help you as well. And so from the get-go, you know, even when I started hacking it together, and now we have more competent people working on it, it is this model of. You know, and this is kind of a philosophical belief that I and other people have. I'm definitely not the first person to articulate this, is that the reason why a lot of students struggle in mathematics isn't because math is hard or because they somehow aren't capable of processing it, What happens is the students go through their curriculum, they have to learn something at a fixed pace. When you learn something at a fixed pace, it's pretty much going to ensure that you're going to have some gaps. I mean, in our current system, when you get a C on a test, the system says, okay, too bad, you're a C student, now let's learn the next more advanced thing, even though you have clearly some gaps. And so even with my cousins, this was predicated on, okay, well, what if we let students fill those gaps at their own time, their own pace, get as much feedback as they want? And so that's the premise of the software and the videos. And what if we arm teachers with dashboards so they can see who has what gap, and so that we could hopefully liberate the classroom from, you know, this kind of Prussian model of lecture, homework, exam, move on type of thing.
You're really talking about changing the mindset of students in the classroom, that math isn't hard, that it's an experience. And you even talk about the beauty of mathematics, which I find fascinating. That wasn't my experience of learning math. Like, when I actually tried to take multivariable calculus again on Khan Academy this morning, I did not have a beautiful experience, I will say.
Really? I thought, so you just have to remediate some gaps, and then I think you'll find the multivariable, because I thought you were going to say, like, I finally saw the beauty in multivariable calculus, because it is beautiful. It is. Anyway, don't take my word for it. There's a website for that. You can...
But you're really trying to change the mindset of the students that are going through the process. And I want to understand a little bit more about what that shift is. Where do you see the shift of mindset really going? And how do you think that's going to impact how we learn if we're able to shift that mindset?
Yeah, you know, it started, and this is before I had read all the literature on it and everything, and before I had kind of experienced this journey. I saw it with my cousin, Nadia, the first Khan Academy student, where... she was 12 years old, had trouble with an exam, and when I talked to her, she had just completely checked out. She says, I'm no good at math. I just can't get math. And it was just painful even having a conversation. She was guessing answers. She wasn't engaging in things. But we kind of persisted through that, and a month later, something finally clicked. And it was funny. Her reaction when it finally clicked, and it was unit conversion that she was having trouble with, she was almost angry. She was angry that this thing called unit conversion was convincing her that she's not smart. And when it finally clicked, she's like, oh my God, this changes everything for me. And that same Nadia, who at the end of sixth grade had bombed a placement test, 3 years later, in ninth grade, was taking calculus at the University of New Orleans. And so, I'm pretty proud of it, too. but I'm not here to show off for my cousins. The point is that, like, there's a, and we've learned it over and over and over again, even the testimonials we heard today, is most people are in Nadia's shoes, and through a combination of changing mindset and then having tools to empower that mindset. You know, there's all this research, and we're doing actually this push on, I don't know how familiar you are with growth mindset and grit. Growth mindset is work from Carol Dweck at Stanford, grit, Angela Duckworth at University of Pennsylvania. It's this whole idea around people either have a fixed mindset or a growth mindset. Fixed mindset, they think ability is innate. Growth mindset, they think that they can grow their brains by struggling, persevering, which is backed by actual research. And we are trying to push that out there because we've been running these own studies on Khan Academy. We've been putting growth mindset quotes. Your brain is like a muscle. The more you use it, the more it grows. And just with quotes like that, we've been seeing 4% improvement in the number of problems that a student does, the more that they engage. So what we've realized, and we're very close to these researchers, are we can use our platform to get some of the pure mindset stuff out there more. But what's also exciting is, you know, 20 years ago, you could tell someone, hey, have a growth mindset. You could struggle more, persevere more. But you didn't have that many tools at your disposal to apply that growth mindset. And to some degree, we hope that Khan Academy is one of, and there's others out there on the internet, but hopefully one of the primary tools where you can really exercise that growth mindset.
And you've been consistent saying this isn't a silver bullet. This isn't, you sit at Khan Academy, you can learn all you need to learn and be a great learner and a fantastic human at the end of your experience online. This is really a tool to enable better teaching, better coaching, as it were. And you've done a lot of these experiments implementing it in schools here locally in the Bay Area. Can you take us inside some of the experiments and what the results are when we start to look at this across a spectrum of students instead of just one and two at home?
Yeah, no, and I'll just second that. It's definitely not a silver bullet, and, you know, I think sometimes we're the victim of, you know, overall you have good press, but sometimes people in the press want to write, like, you know, hyperbolic headlines, like, you know, the math of Khan, or, you know, I like that one. But it, it, it,
the math.
We're still trying to.
How often do you get Star Trek 2 quotes in media reports?
I can't get enough of them. I embrace it. Although it's actually the Khan in Star Trek is Khandunium Singh, so it's actually but he is from the subcontinent though. But he's a Sikh superhuman. I don't know if you.
Today I learned.
But his last name is
Sal Khan is a fan of Star Trek.
I thought that was common knowledge. From the beginning, this was always, this was a tool for me when I was a tutor for my cousins. That's how it was built. That's why, the coach tools were there on day one, really, of Khan Academy. And even before I'd quit my job, we were working with local summer camps, some schools. And, the dream is, how can we empower the teacher so that a teacher can actually address the needs of the 20 students, the 30 students who are in the room, so that they don't have to shepherd them all together at the same pace. And once again, not a new idea. This was what education was 300 years ago, when very few people had access to education, but those who did had a private tutor and it was completely personalized. Then you had kind of the advent with the Industrial Revolution of public education, which was a great thing. It's definitely led to kind of having a broader middle class, especially in the countries that were the first to adopt public education. But part of that was a sacrifice of if we're going to educate everyone, we have to do it somewhat cost effectively. Well, how do we do that? Well, how do we do anything at scale cost effectively? We batch things together. We move them together at a set pace. We apply some processes to them at different stations. A bell's going to ring every hour. And at some point, we'll sort them out. These oranges go to the farmer's market, and these get squeezed for orange juice.
I can only imagine the headline tomorrow.
Yeah, these are made on the fly, as you get. Yes, so that was always kind of a hope, is that we could make a tool to have the best of both worlds. And so we started working with schools, and I think what we've learned so far is that when used well, and we're still trying to define what well is, we've seen some pretty amazing things happen. There's a school in Oakland, California, charter school, Oakland Unity. They've in 4 years, and once again, I don't think Khan Academy was the tool to enable their amazing teacher to do what he wanted to do. He was always focused on mindset. He was always viewed himself not as the disseminator of information, but the person who could sit down next to students and change their mindset towards learning. But he needed a tool where he could differentiate each of the students. And this is a school that 4 years ago was in the 22nd percentile in the state of California for ninth grade algebra classes. This last year, they were in the 99.9 percentile. And I want to be very careful saying that. I mean, it's fun for me to point that out. And Peter McIntosh, the teacher there, he gets 99% of the credit for it. But we celebrate that with him. But it's not like we can just drop ship Khan Academy to a random classroom, and then all of a sudden the butterflies will fly and the flowers will bloom. It's a tool. It's only like any other tool, and it's only going to be and we're still learning. So our goal right now is find the Peter McIntoshes out there in the world. Meet them, understand what they're doing, document what they're doing, and then try to share it with as many educators as possible.
You're listening to a broadcast of the Commonwealth Club of California. Become a member of the Commonwealth Club and support the club and its radio broadcast by visiting www.commonwealthclub.org.
How does Peter McIntosh find you?
How did he find us? If I remember correctly, he was just incredibly persistent. I think it was as early as 2010, he was reaching out to us, and we had already started some pilots with some other schools that were already also showing some things, and he said, I want to be part of it, and we had a process, because, I think we had 300 schools that wanted to be part of this first pilot, and we could only do it with 50, and he didn't get into that first batch, but he kept writing us letters, and eventually, I think a member of our team said, they're in Oakland, let me go visit. And she came back saying, it's incredible what's going on there. And then we started to really pay more attention.
So every election cycle, we're inundated with stories on education. This last one, it was good teachers versus bad teachers. Mm. Or unions are destroying the classroom. Teacher tenure is a problem here in California. And it feels like we're just being parroted talking points that are political and not really delving into what is needed. I'm really curious from your position of now implementing Khan Academy in schools, what your perspective on what is actually going on. What do teachers really need to make headway? Because the numbers are stark in terms of how we're doing as a nation.
Yeah, no, and it's an well, there's actually two interesting ideas that you're bringing up. One is how do we empower teachers more and enable them to do what they need to do? The other question is kind of the national question, which I think is a slightly different question. On teachers, you know, what we try to do at Khan Academy, this is what I personally believe, and you know, especially going through this journey, I've been directly exposed. You know, I don't just read the headlines anymore. I've been able to meet people in these different contexts, and you know, our goal is to kind of stay out of this, the conversation of, you know, union's good, union's bad, you know, vouchers or, you know, student teacher ratio, all of these, you know, ours is whatever the resources are, whatever the constraints, we want to work with the people who are working in those constraints to make the best possible outcome for their students. And for us, yeah, I mean, it's really just, you know, our tools are kind of, our teacher tools are designed by some of those first teachers that we work and we continue to get feedback from them. I think teachers need more flexibility in what they do. I think there's been this negative cycle of every time we get scared on PISA scores because, you know, our ninth graders are behind the Estonians when it comes to factoring polynomials, which is true. we get scared and we clamp down on what happens in classrooms more and more in a top-down way, and that problem that might help kind of the very worst performing schools, it kind of raises the floor, but it also drops the ceiling. A lot of the more creative teachers are not able to kind of practice their art anymore. So I would actually go more in the direction of liberating what's happening in the classroom. And you know, with respect to kind of the international comparisons, I actually think that's where a lot of the conversation. We absolutely should pay attention to these things, and the better our all students can perform on math tests and whatever, that's good. But I think it misses the point because, you know, we'll compare ourselves to South Korea or to the, you know, Shanghai or to Finland and feel insecure about America, we should copy what they're doing. But what we don't realize is there's a group almost every week from South Korea or Finland that's visiting actually this area saying, what are we doing wrong? We're getting the test scores, but we don't have entrepreneurship the way that you have in America, especially the way you have in Silicon Valley. We don't. And preaching to the choir, but it's true. And I think you know, and I write this in my book. It's what we should be thinking about is instead of trying to make our Prussian model more like the Prussian model in South Korea or the Prussian model in Finland or the Prussian model in Shanghai. I hope this doesn't sound a little bit too like, you know, red, white, and blue wave the flag, but it's going to. I think we need to make our model more American. And when I say more American, much more entrepreneurial, embrace failure. You know, failure, embracing failure is, I won't say uniquely American thing, but it's definitely something that defines American culture, especially Silicon Valley, which I think is like the most American part of America. Yes. So there's some people in the audience like, really? Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, we are the most American part of America. Yeah.
Somehow I don't think this broadcast is going to do well.
Yeah. No,
outside of this local environment.
I think it will. There are many American parts of America in different ways.
Sal Khan said there are many Americas.
But it is about embracing entrepreneurialism, mm-hmm. creativity, questioning, not, you know, just taking orders, setting goals, taking ownership of things, differentiating, personalizing. This is what Silicon Valley is about. That's what America's about. And I think our school system can move more in that direction by loosening constraints without loosening rigor. Because what's needed, some of these tools allow us to maintain rigor without maintaining kind of the stranglehold on what happens minute by minute.
So functionally, you're talking about more of a bottom-up approach, that's where we need to focus attention on so that teachers are empowered, that we still take into account what we're doing great in learning right now. And one thing I saw on the site, which was unique, is this notion of building a portfolio, mm-hmm. which is not something that existed when I was a kid, when I went through public school. is this idea of making something that really demonstrates what I know rather than my test score telling you what I know. And yeah. I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about this portfolio project and the
yeah.
idea behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's funny. A lot of the stuff I'm describing is kind of the reality of today, although very few people have recognized it, where even today when we're hiring at Khan Academy, whether it's an engineer or a designer or really anyone, we want to see their portfolio. Hey, show us the blog. Show us paintings you've made. I mean, it could be unrelated, but we want to see evidence of creative talent. And if it's related to the job you're doing, if you're going to be a mobile programmer and you have mobile apps you've written, all the better. And if we're impressed enough by that portfolio, we might not even look at your GPA. We might not even care about kind of the more traditional metrics. And I think as we go into a kind of a creative world, and I think once again in this kind of global economy, this is going to be the niche for America, which is the best niche to have, which is kind of the creative arts. And even things that, you know, like engineering, which, you know, it always bothered me when people didn't consider engineering to be a creative thing. It's about creating new things. But especially now, you can see kind of this mixture of design and engineering and computer science is becoming very, very relevant. And so, yeah, I think I tell this to all my cousins. I tell this to everyone I know. Yes, do good in school, but the most important thing you're going to have, the most important asset, is a portfolio of artifacts that you have built up over your education. That's what's going to get you a job. And so the credential of the future is going to be, yes, there's going to be your test scores, you know, your grammar, your mathematics, that kind of stuff. I think that's going to be the least important part of your credential of the future, or the transcript of the future. The two most important parts are going to be this portfolio of creative works, and then evidence of kind of what people think of you when they worked in a team, what kind of a mentor were you, what kind of a leader were you. And that's why when, you know, we go into schools, yes, we want students to learn at their own pace, but we want it to be alongside their peers. And, you know, we promote a lot of peer-to-peer learning, which is a two-way street. Yes, peer-to-peer learning allows everyone to get one-on-one attention, but it also allows the teacher to really, when I say the teacher, the student teacher, to build that muscle of empathy and communication, which, like a portfolio, is one of the most important skills to have.
This whole field of education happening online is fraught with criticism, especially when it comes to these massive online courses that have been developed. And the most common criticism I hear, and I'm wondering if this applies to what you're seeing at Khan Academy, is we see so many people start projects, start courses online and never complete them, and never follow through. And is this a problem that's happening with online education? There's no system for follow through.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And although, you know, just as a baseline, I love what the MOOCs are doing, edX, Coursera, Udacity, because to some degree they're helping us with our mission of a free world class education for anyone anywhere. And on kind of a surface level, what they're doing is similar. They're creating resources, they're sharing it with folks, they're putting it out there for free. I think the difference, and this is kind of leading to some of this criticism, is at the end of the day, though, they've taken the course model. You know, they literally said, okay, there's a course at Stanford. Let's try to create a course, that same course, oftentimes, for 100,000 students, which is great, but it still has the same properties as a Stanford course. It starts on a certain day. It moves at a fixed pace. It ends at a certain day. And anytime you're doing something at a fixed pace, you can definitely learn something, but it also essentially becomes something of an assessment. Can you keep up with this Stanford computer science class? Can you keep up with this MIT computer science class? And you're not a full-time student anymore, and you might have family, and you might have a job. And so I don't think it's the nature of the content that's leading to some of this criticism. I think it's actually that artificial constraint on, hey, let's, you know, and some of them are very proud. Hey, we want to make sure that this course is of the same rigor as, you know, this is an MIT course. And, you know, I was like, well, then very few people will be able to keep up with it. and which is an important point, because it doesn't mean, you know, the words dumb and slow have become synonyms in our language, even though they are not the same word. In fact, sometimes they could be the complete opposite. The person who wants to spend more time to process it might be drawing more connections. And so core to who we are is, look, if it's going to take you 5 years to learn multivariable calculus, that's great. And not only that, but I suspect the person who's going to take 5 years to learn multivariable calculus is going to understand it far better than the person who did it in a semester, and might actually be able to contribute in ways that are unexpected. You know, your ability to contribute to a field is much more dependent on your creativity than your ability to kind of keep up with the pace. You know, the example is, you know, right now we're evaluating people's mathematic ability based on their ability to kind of do, you know, factor polynomials, do this math problem. And the analogy is it's like evaluating future painters or a painter's potential based on how well they mix paint. Or it's like evaluating a dancer's potential based on how flexible they are. And you're completely losing the creative aspect. I mean, to contribute to the field of mathematics or to apply mathematics, you need to be a creative person. And it's sometimes almost a crime because we might be losing some of our most creative people because they weren't mixing paint right or they weren't flexible to start with. So I think the bottom line is this drop-off rate, this attrition, is an artifact of having a fixed pace, which, by the way, I think happens in the traditional realm too, right? In the traditional realm, you move anyone through a fixed pace. If I take, if I were allowed 100,000 people to fit into a lecture hall at UCSF, you'll probably have the same types of attrition.
So on the subject of potential, let's throw it to the audience for questions.
You teach about history. I encourage you to teach about the future, because you can study the future. Here's my question about the future. The singularity folks are talking about the merging of technology and humans, including microchips and everything else. How does that change the future of learning?
Yes. maybe we should get something to drink and we could talk about this a little more. Look, there is something happening here. This is something I talk to the team about all the time. Where, you know, if you go back 400 years, and if you were to survey, you know, even in Western Europe, which at that time was one of the more literate parts of the world, you had a literacy rate on the order of 10 or 15%. And if you ask someone then what percentage of people do you think are even capable of reading, they might have said maybe 30 or 40%. You know, now we know that number is 99% are capable of reading. And I like to ask, well, what similar blinders do we have on today? What if the number of people who can understand multivariable calculus or genetics or biomedical engineering is not 5% of the population? What if it's 100% of the population? What will happen to the rate at which society could advance and develop and how much more merit we can kind of allow to fulfill their potential? So I think something is happening here. I think we're at the very early stages where you have things like Khan Academy, you have things like MOOCs, which are doing it, you know, hopefully in 50 years, 100 years, they will seem primitive. And that, you know, in 50 years, there could be more immersive things. There could be, you know, it might sound a little dystopian, like, you know, you just plug in. I don't know, but this is one of the things I'm excited about. But I think the key, as we go through all of this, and this is something we stay focused on at Khan Academy, it isn't about technology for technology's sake. It is how can we leverage technology to make essentially a more human world. You know, everything that we're doing in the classroom, the classrooms that are using Khan Academy well. It's not like, you know, some Vulcan or Borg reality where, like, every kid is sitting there just doing, you know, and, like, learning math facts or something. It feels more human. They're talking to each other. They're able to move around. They're forming bonds with the teacher. They have more time to do projects. So my hope, and this is definitely something that the Khan Academy team is going to fight for, is how do we leverage technology to make this future not be dystopic, so it becomes a more human and empowered reality as opposed to a Vulcan or Borg one?
Building on this question of the future, and you say in your mission really clearly, a free education for everyone, everywhere. How do we fulfill the everywhere part?
Yes. Today, in the developed world, you have about 70% internet penetration, 30%. Even in the Bay Area, 30% of families don't have internet at home. In the rest of the world, especially the developing world, it's flipped the other way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we are predicated on having access. The good answer, the neat thing is, if you look at the adoption curve of computer, or especially mobile technology, you know, most of the developing world is going to leapfrog the computer. They're going straight to mobile. If you look at the adoption curve of that, especially smartphones, which is a small computer, it's faster than almost any technology in history. You know, it might not be fast enough for us because we're in the middle of the adoption curve right now, but it's faster than the washing machine, the television, the automobile. And so, you know, it's not a good...
So you're optimistic that access is not going to be a hurdle in years future to education?
It is a hurdle like today, this. And, you know, I wish there was a way to reach every person tomorrow, but but the good thing is that we can, since it is based on this technology, which is, to some degree, riding Moore's law now, it makes you very optimistic about where we're going to be in 10 or 15 years, where almost any device you're going to have access to a lot. Once again, not just information, not just interactive exercises, but a whole community of learners that in an ideal world you have that, plus you can plug in with either formal systems or ad hoc physical systems to learn more.
Let's go to our next question.
What did you make the black hole badges for?
The black hole badges. So for those of you who are not as expert in Khan Academy terminology, as I suspect you are, the black hole badge is the most prestigious badge that one can earn on Khan Academy, and I suspect that you have not earned it yet.
No.
Yes.
I think multivariable calculus is in the way.
Yes. So I will tell you a little secret. No one other than myself has earned a black hole badge yet. So it is possible to earn it, but we have made it very hard. And I actually did not earn it. I had a favor happen. Well, the reason why we did it is because I would participate on the Khan Academy community, and people thought I was like a fake Sal. And so we like, how do we prove to people that I'm actually me? And so, oh, well, we need to give you a black hole badge because no one else would have a black hole badge. But anyway, yes. So there will be ways to achieve it, so keep working.
With the struggles and the burdens that students are facing now, with the debt overload and just the anxiety and the stress that comes along with that, how do you envision the Khan Academy changing or innovating that paradigm of traditional, you know, traditional academia or postgraduate studies?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. You're right. Especially higher education, it's, you know, growing 5% faster than the rate of inflation, which can't occur forever. Otherwise, it will just like take over the universe. And so I think irrespective of things like Khan Academy or MOOCs, I think, you know, something was going to give and maybe even is starting to give. I think if we go into the future, education is a bunch of things that people often jumble together. People most associate it with learning, but it's also, you know, there's kind of a social learning aspect to it, community aspect, and then there's a credentialing aspect to it. And the credential aspect is kind of, I think, what this is focused on. You know, there's an interesting thought experiment. If you were to, you know, if you go to, say, the graduation at Harvard or Stanford or UCSF, and you were to ask, you know, okay, you can keep your degree, you can say that you're, you know, blah, 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 but you can never tell anyone that you went to Harvard, but I'll pay your tuition. Are you cool with that? No one would take you up on that offer. And what that tells you is that what they paid the tuition for, I'm sure they enjoyed the experience and they learned a lot and all of that, but what really wanted was to be able to say, I went to Harvard, I went to Stanford, or I went to UCSF, whatever it might be. My hope is, and I think you're going to start seeing this in the next 5 or 10 years, I don't know if Khan Academy will be involved in some way, is you're going to see alternate paths that, and this is the key, that are not lesser paths, that are not vocational paths, that are not alternate paths that the best and the brightest will want to do, because it just makes sense for them to do it. Since you're Canadian, I'll give an example. University of Waterloo, which is kind of like the MIT of Canada. Right now in Silicon Valley, all of the interns are from Waterloo, because you know summer's over, but Waterloo is their engineering program. 2/3 of their time is in internships. And I interview, you know, when I talk to these Waterloo students, and it's not like, you know, these kids are as academic and as worldly as any students that I've ever met, and they graduate with a really valuable degree where they have a lot of job offers, not with debt. Most of them have several tens of thousands of dollars in savings because they've been able to do these internships, and their tuition is lower. I think the Canadian government has something to do with it too, but also because so much of their time is in the field.
Well, you see the private sector as being a huge component in driving this shift in how credentials might happen in the future.
Credentials are driven by the consumer of the credential. Mm-hmm. So if Google starts to pay attention to some new credential tomorrow, or if, you know, say Goldman Sachs starts to pay attention to some new credential tomorrow, that's going to become a real credential, and especially if many of them start to pay attention to it. And I think a lot of corporations, and this isn't about kind of trying to turn out people to be kind of corporate, you know, operatives and all of this. Most of what the corporations are craving, especially folks like Google and Facebook and all the rest, they're craving people who are more intellectual, more creative, more capable of tackling on, you know, an ambiguous domain that they've never seen before. And so they aren't finding a strong correlation between traditional GPAs and traditional credentials and that skill, that creative skill that they're looking for. So I think my guess is they will be the drivers of where some of this goes.
What are you still learning?
What am I still learning? Really good question. So at kind of the most basic level, I'm taking piano lessons right now. I'll get there. But I would say the things that I'm finding myself learning the most is, I have two children now and one is on the way. So I think just like learning what it means to be a parent, I think is a fairly deep and mysterious thing that I struggle with every day, but I'm enjoying it. As an organization like Khan Academy grows, you know, we have this amazing team of incredible people. I mean, the best advice I could give to any entrepreneur is just hire a bunch of people smarter than yourself, which I have done. But how do you make sure that this is the type of place that everyone wants to work at, that's the type of place where they feel fulfilled, you know, not just for a paycheck, but they feel like they can get up in the morning and feel good about the work they do. So I'm learning to be a better, whatever you want to call it, leader or manager or whatever, and it's not easy. So I'm definitely learning there. On top of that, I like to read a lot of I like to read a lot of history books.
How do you do it? How do you convince the schools to try the video tutorials?
The simple answer is, we've put it out there, and it's just kind of been a grassroots word of mouth thing. The one thing that we definitely avoid trying to do is trying to do like a top down or try to sell them on it. I mean, it's really, if a teacher or student finds it valuable, we want to give them whatever can be valuable for them. But if otherwise, it's completely fine for them to choose other things.
I've always wondered, after watching hundreds of your videos, is there a SalCon blooper reel out there? You can't possibly go through all of these without messing up.
Well, if you watch enough of the videos, you will see that some of them are the blooper reels. That they are. I remember there's one video. I mean, this was in the early days when they were for the cousins, but some of these videos are still up there where it's like a telemarketer called and I like didn't feel like pressing pause on the record, so I was like, no, sorry, I'm not interested, and I just hung up. And you know, there's a video, I think it's still up there, where it's like, you know, my wife has been incredibly supportive of this. I sometimes get obsessive about things, and there was a time in about 2006, 2007 where I was like every waking moment I was like recording videos, and she was like trying to make sure I had some balance in my life, and she was like, okay, no more than this many hours a day, and one day she was coming home from residency, and I'm like, oh yeah, I better do this one really fast. My wife is here. I can't record videos right now, and I.
But. My question is, have you ever thought about, you know, teaching courses on other kind of like subjects, something like more personal instead of just like something that's more just K-12 kind of related?
Yeah, so I mean, we do have a lot of, and it's not just by me, I mean, I said art history content, we have some history content, all of that. We have, I'm not supposed to, so I have a vision of, because I actually think the other thing that's good on demand is advice. Because you don't want your dad like, hey, well, this is how I would do it, and like, oh, whatever, dad. But like, sometimes in your moment when you actually are trying to make that decision, well, I wish I had dad on demand, and he doesn't get the satisfaction of knowing that I'm listening to his advice. There is a secret stash of dating videos that I've started to make for my kids. With the idea that, you know, right now I'm cool 37-year-old dad who's kind of closer to the game. And so, you know, by the time they're actually going to be dating, I'm going to be like lame 50-year-old dad. So maybe they would want advice from cool 37-year-old dad. But it's unclear if that will ever go beyond the family, but we'll see.
Maybe. There is a wonderfully mortified look on the Khan Academy employees here in the front row as you're answering that question. Our last question. Yes. Go ahead.
Hello. How do you see Khan Academy and other online tools interacting with hardware technology education in the future?
Yeah, no, I think there's going to be some really interesting things. I mean, you know, like, you know, I mean, I'm fascinated by virtual reality, even if I wasn't in education. But you know, there's going to be some really fascinating things from stuff like virtual reality, where it's or things like Kinect, where you can, you know, you can see what people are doing. But you know, I was actually at the Stanford VR lab recently, and they showed me the simulation. I thought it was incredible, where you're wearing the goggles, but it looks like you're in a room like this, where there's like literally 1,000 people looking at you and following you around, and it's to get over anxiety of giving of public speaking. And you know, that type of thing, I think, is going to be absolutely revolutionary. As a history class, you'll be able to immerse yourself in ancient Rome. You'll be able to, cosmology. You'll be able to travel to the stars. So, I think that's exciting. I think mobile is where it just says, or gestural, I should say, not mobile. I mean, they might end up being this big, but. I think we're just at the nascent stages of kind of understanding what human gestures and natural gestures are going to do for us. A spoken language, a machine, machine vision. There might be one day where there are researchers who are already trying to read emotion from people and using that as cues for what the computer can do better. So I think we're at the very early stages. Holodeck, yes.
And just to
what's that? I never heard of it.
Con. Sal, here at Inform, we always ask one question to finish up. What is your 60-second idea to change the world?
I guess it would be too self-serving to say Khan Academy would. Yeah. So just for fun, I'll throw out another crazy idea that has nothing to do. Well, I have to say Khan Academy. So definitely Khan Academy. I definitely think we're at like a nascent stage where we can reach everyone, empower everyone, and we can change mindsets. A lot of what we're thinking about at Khan Academy is how can we do a mindset intervention for the country so people go from this fixed mindset to a growth mindset. Imagine what might happen. But there's other ideas. The current. Oh, thank you. And now I'll say a crazy idea, or not so crazy, but and this comes from a science fiction book, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, but it's this idea, and it got me thinking about, our current democracy is geographic-based, because that's the way the world was 300 years ago, where if you wanted to communicate, you have to get on your pony and, travel to D.C., but I think there could be other models now that are not geography-based, so I'll just throw that out there.
Please join me in thanking our speaker tonight. Sal Khan, the 21st Century Visionary Award winner for the Informa.
Thank you.
And with that, this forum with the Commonwealth Club is concluded.